All right, solo rip from me today. How are you doing, guys? Three subjects, as usual. The macro picture at the moment, the power of podcasting, and finally, real estate and a situation I recently found myself in. Let's start off with the macro investment picture right now. It's really interesting. Like, what the hell's going on out there? The fear and greed index is very easy to follow. Exactly how it's calculated, I've never digged into the details, so that's actually making me think I should go and do that once I finish recording. But basically, people are really scared right now, and the markets are reflecting that. The big R word has come out. Ooh, recession. Maybe there's going to be a recession. What's going on? And so that there are some indicators we can look at that help us to navigate these treacherous waters as capital allocators. And some of the things that are flashing up for me are pretty obvious, actually. So I'll try and work through them as they come to mind. But first of all, am I scared? No, I'm not. It's very simple. Like, I have a large allocation to Bitcoin as a weighted percentage in my portfolio. It's in self-custody, so it can't be taken away from me or debased. And the primary thesis for Bitcoin accumulation and capital growth is very much still in play. What's going on right now is a little bit of noise. It's a bump in the process. Nothing goes up in a straight line. And so don't expect to buy Bitcoin and get rich tomorrow. Like, that is absolutely not what's happening here. And I like the phrase, like, Bitcoin is a not get poor slowly scheme, which is effectively what's happening when you leave your dollars in a bank account and they get eroded with inflation. So some of the signals I'm looking at are, first of all, the 10-year government debt markets. These are useful to pay attention to purely just to see, like, what is the confidence in a currency? What is the confidence from the marketplace given to a government's ability to pay their bills? And in America, it's markedly improved. Like, people are more confident. And it's interesting because there's almost like a sense of austerity that the Trump administration is currently bringing in, and the Department of Government Efficiency just chopping all this cost out. That means the taxpayer is not going to be so burdened. It means that in theory, the government won't rack debt up as fast as it previously was. And basically, they are more accountable. And you're like, oh my God, this is fascinating. It's a twist in the tail. I generally have this kind of carte blanche approach to governments are completely unable to manage themselves effectively. They're unaccountable. There's no true owner or manager. And they basically use the taxpayer as a get out of jail free card. And either they increase taxes or they do a stealth tax through inflation by printing money. And the debt to GDP levels have reached such a state that it's basically just a mathematical calculation to show that they cannot not print more money. But I wasn't necessarily factoring in the idea that they might just get slightly better at balancing their books. And in particular, the US is such a key driver here because they are the reserve currency of the world. And with that power comes great responsibility, ironically. But if they can balance their books more effectively as a federal government and on a state level, then they won't necessarily need to print so much money because they won't take on so much more debt. And that debt burden becomes less of a problem for them. Now, is that actually happening? Will they actually be able to take the costs out that they are claiming they are doing? Time will tell. But the 10-year long US Treasury market shows you clearly that people have more confidence in them than they did 3 or 4 weeks ago. Okay, that's very interesting. What else is going on elsewhere? Well, I read that the Japanese, the UK, and the Eurozone debt costs have gone up. And that's essentially a vote of no confidence. And so what happens in an environment in where, like, most global markets are looking recessionary, or markets are fearful, or markets are clearly voting with their money and saying, you know, we want you to pay us more if you want to borrow money from us for 10 years because we don't think you're going to pay us back. Like, that's a vote of no confidence. And that filters through to the United States, whether or not they're strong or not. These other places that they trade with, very important they're trading on a well, not a fair playing field, that's the wrong way of saying it, but basically, if your trading partners are going backwards, you're not going to make as much money. If you can't make as much money, they drag you down. And lo and behold, these other economies are going to put the brakes on what happens elsewhere. So that's quite interesting. Like, what does the long-term debt market teach us? And I always pay like a little bit of attention to that. The next is gold. Like, gold has rocketed in the last 4 weeks. Like, why is that? The oldest and soundest money that, you know, humans ever had access to, and generally considered a bit of a canary in the coal mine when it comes to inflation. So it's like, hang on, so why would government debt get cheaper in the US, but at the same time, gold start moving? And that, to me, is an example of people going, actually, I need to hold the soundest assets I can get hold of. And in my opinion, I mean, I'd be selling that bond tomorrow. Absolutely no doubt about it. But still, these are interesting mechanics. Where this is going is my view at this point is sit tight. The bull market for Bitcoin, at least, hasn't got going. Not truly. We haven't really seen retail get that excited. You look at the Google search metrics, like, there's nothing really that important looking at historical search numbers. And basically just got to sit tight. We're in a bit of a trend here. These 60-day periods play out and the moving averages play out. And a price can only move so far. So when we were sitting at $105,000, $110,000 of Bitcoin, that is fresh territory, right? And the energy required to get up to that point, it peters out. And then the bears kind of take control. And like all markets, things like they lull and then they ebb. The night is darkest just before the dawn. And so right now, blood on the streets, start buying. Or the contrarians are looking for, like, do the opposite to the herd. And if I was the US government and I had just passed into law using an executive order, the ability to take Bitcoin onto my balance sheet, and I've got a lot of assets that are just basically eroding in purchasing power on my balance sheet, I'd be looking to reallocate as many of them as possible. Like, you'll note in the executive order, there's a wording along the lines of, like, all Bitcoin purchasing must be budget neutral, which to me basically means they're not going to print money and buy Bitcoin. But it doesn't mean that they can't move stuff around, sell things, and buy Bitcoin. And the first thing I'd be doing is scaring the market and being like, yep, sorry, guys, the asset inflation that you're all expecting to see because of money printing, well, look, we're getting super efficient. The show's over. We can balance our books. But the price comes off. And, you know, Bitcoin's down from its high of 110K or whatever it was a couple months ago. And even in the last 4 weeks, it's off another 10%. This is a buying opportunity. Absolutely. And what people confuse is the difference between price and value. And so just to kind of harp on value for a moment, do I believe that governments have the ability to balance their books long term? No. Do I believe that central banks could continue to print money out of nothing in order to support governments? Yes. Okay. Well, inflationary monetary policy is here to stay. If that's the case, then sound money or sound assets like Bitcoin, like gold, represent a way to actually store purchasing power over time. So I don't know when it's going to happen, but I have a good hunch that it's going to. And so there's no place I prefer to be than Bitcoin in self-custody, because you're like, you have all the upside potential. Yes, there's some volatility to the downside in the short term, but do I need to spend it right now? No, I just got to hold it. And yeah, it's just a really fascinating time. So it's almost like if you were trying to pull the strings and you're like, you know, like, let's pull the price down a bit, there is smart money out there that is accumulating right now. Now, on the flip side, who's selling? Well, there's going to be some people that, you know, YOLO'd in at 100, 105 that have seen it come off by 20%. They're like freaking out and selling. And these are people that just do not understand the value proposition of Bitcoin. Now, I want to draw attention to a great book that I'm reading, Larry Lepard. Shout out to Larry, called The Big Print. And in it, he uses a wonderful analogy that helps you, I think, really drill into like what's going on right now, which is he's a pilot. And as pilots, I've never flown myself, but this makes a huge amount of sense just from a first principles basis. As a pilot, you are constantly scanning for potential problems. And those potential problems can be any manner of different things that threaten the safety of your flight. How many airports are within range of where you are right now with the current levels of fuel that you've got? Is it foggy? Is it windy? Like, what are the other weather conditions to consider? How many other current flights are airborne in and around you? that pilot is essentially constantly doing checks all around them for potential risks. And how Larry points out the current monetary system is basically the reason that planes crash is not just one bad decision. It's a consistent connection of poor decision-making. So, for example, you could check the weather forecast and you want to take your plane out and you're like, you've been dying to do it for a few days and you're like, I'm just going to do it, even though it looks a bit blustery and it looks like there might be a bit of cloud cover at some point. And so you take to the air and up you go. And suddenly you can see the clouds drawing in. You've gone a little further than you thought you wanted to. You took a plane with two engines and one of the engines pumps out. You're like, holy shit, this is a massive problem, a completely unexpected problem. But it compounds on the fact that now the weather's drawing in and you're further away from the airport than you wanted to be. And so suddenly the amount of options that you have to actually bail yourself out of trouble gets smaller and smaller. It's like, are there any other airports I can get to? Yes or no. Is there another engine I can use? Yes or no. Is there more fuel I can get from somewhere? Yes or no. Like, how bad is the weather forecast going to get? And the analogy is, you know, for 100 years, essentially, as central banking and modern monetary theory has become part of the economy of today, they've started to use different tools over time that compound to create the problem. And so today, when debt to GDP levels are sitting at, you know, circa 130% of GDP, no economy has ever actually come back from the precipice that is that debt to GDP level. But they've almost always defaulted. I think Japan is the only example of a country that currently hasn't. But equally, the problems that they have and the yen carry trader are well documented, and I recommend looking into that. Point being is that whether they, you know, use quantitative easing or they use stimulus or they start actually tapering off their balance sheet, whatever different tools a central bank has at its disposal, it's essentially like that pilot that's flying that is reducing the amount of options they have available to them to safely land the plane each time they intervene in the market. And that's what's going on at the moment. It's like, okay, fine. Asset prices have come off momentarily. There's a bit of fear in the market. Maybe they can balance the books. But actually, I don't think that's possible. And you look at all the errors that have happened over the last 10, 20, 30 years when it comes to like zero interest rate policies. So what do you mean the cost of capital is zero? That cannot be true. If that's true, the capital itself is worth zero. And so what I'm trying to say is that right now is a lull. And there's some interesting things going on in the market that they don't really give me cause for concern when I sit in Bitcoin self-custody, but you can look at them and you can start to make decisions of your own. It's like, actually, maybe this is a buying opportunity. Could I reallocate some capital from a different area of things that I own into Bitcoin that at $85,000 I think is an absolute steal? And come August of this year, maybe even September, we're going to look back on this March and be like, wow, I mean, I can't believe the last 6 months actually just happened. But the point is, it's like a balloon that's blowing up, falling back, blowing up bigger, falling back, blowing up bigger, falling back. And it's as more and more capital has been pulled out of the analog world into this new digital store of value that is Bitcoin. Some other areas just to kind of focus on, which are interesting to think about, is what the stock markets have done. And if you look at the credit cycle trends of the last 50, 100 years, you know, going from inflationary to deflationary, inflationary to deflationary, you'll see quite clearly that things like commodities and gold tend to do pretty well in inflationary periods, and vice versa, equities markets perform differently on the other side. And so are we going into a super inflationary environment? Are we about to see, as Larry calls it, the big print? The amount of money that's about to get printed by the Federal Reserve is mind-bogglingly big compared to what was done before. It's kind of like a heroin addict, right? You try a little bit. Ooh, that felt good. Try a little bit more. Ooh, that felt really good. Before you know it, you're getting the biggest hits you've ever had and you're completely addicted. And that's what modern monetary theory essentially is. It's like they are a crack addict, just feeding, feeding, feeding. And each time they need a bigger and bigger hit to make the system function. And frankly, it's a wild time. Like I don't believe there are many people out there that view the world the way I do. And I believe that I view the world in a way that many people will do so in the future. Time will tell if I'm right or wrong. And what's interesting here is I just see value so, so differently. And it's impossible to unsee. Like, I like that phrase. Bitcoin's hard to see because you've got to join a lot of dots together. But once you see it, it's very, very hard to unsee. And this pulls me nicely along. I'll go to point number three. I was going to talk about real estate. So I am someone who was, I was living in a property that wasn't quite right for me and my family long term. And I was getting more and more interested in Bitcoin, particularly as a store of value. And so we decided to sell some real estate to help accumulate some more Bitcoin. I did that with a couple of different things. Now, what I've come to learn about real estate is I struggle to see value in it. And when I say like the matching of the price and the value of course is like you cannot live in a Bitcoin, full stop. So where are you going to live? You need shelter. And depending on what your tastes and preferences are, you've got a certain type of shelter you're looking for, be that location, be that size, be that price, whatever the case might be. But on Monday, I went to view a property that I was really excited about seeing because I thought, you know what, maybe I'll sell down some Bitcoin, pay the deposit, take on some debt, and boom, we're going to have a family home in a place that I really like and of a quality that's what I'm after. And you know, the truth is I was driving all the way there and it's a little bit out of the town I want to live in. And suddenly like, that's a compromise. And then when you get there, it's like, it's what I would describe as like very fiat, which you have to be pretty far down the Bitcoin rabbit hole to kind of comprehend, but it looks nice. It looked really nice. You're like beautiful view with like a pool and some grassy area nearby that, you know, you can see your kids running around and having a great time. But then you're like, what's the price? And the price was like big. I was like, whoa. And then it turned out that they paid an even higher price 2 years ago and that they'd what I would call fix failed. My time as a shipbroker is they'd agreed a price. The owner had agreed it subject to the buyer selling their current house. The current house hadn't been sold, so the sale fell through. And that new price that they already agreed was 20%, 15% lower than their purchase price. So they'd owned the property for 2 years. They were already willing to take a 20% discount. We walked around. We're not surveyors, but we saw straight away like rusty parts of the property. I mean, this has only been built in 2020, 5 years ago. Clear water damage, moisture coming through. What we've learned about where we're currently living is like mold is really, really bad for you. Consistent mold exposure, headaches, skin problems, bad sleep, terrible mood, and like 100% you do not want to be living in a moldy house. What I need is a healthy home, somewhere that, you know, you're not getting exposed to EMFs. You don't have toxic chemicals painted all over the walls. You don't have molds in your bedroom when you're sleeping at night. Lots of sunshine, you know, a bit closer to nature than what I might have had before. And suddenly you're like, why would someone pay that money for this house when it's not those things? So I'm obviously not the right buyer. And it comes back to that concept of like value is subjective. You know, a bottle of water costs you 50p in the local pub. If you're in the middle of the Sahara, you pay $500 for it. That's just a simple example as to how people look at things and get different value from them. And they pay based on their individual value. And that's where the Austrian School of Economics is such a powerful thing to research because it helps you understand the world around you in a way that just isn't possible before. Anyway, where am I going with this? It's like, okay, so I'll give you some like rough numbers, not specific to this property, but just for sake of argument. If someone pays $1 million Australian for a property and 2 years later, the market's come off and they're willing to accept $800,000, has the value proposition of that property changed? Or is there some dynamic going on that the price has been affected by in the wider markets? Good question, right? And then to flip that round, it's like, okay, someone pays $1 million for a property. 2 years later, they're asking $1.2 million for it. Now, they spend 2 years living in that house. So there's more scuff marks. There's more breakage to it. There's usage. Maybe there's a bit of water damage. Maybe the toilet doesn't work properly. Maybe there's now a building site next door. Like, who knows, right? But the property has been used. So why has the price gone up? And what I find with real estate that drives me mad is that most people operating that market have absolutely no idea about the question, what is money? Like none at all. So you say to them, why has the price gone up to 1.2 million over the last couple of years? Oh, the market's really strong. Like here in Australia has a large amount of immigration, for example, that tends to be pointed to as something that props the market up. But no one ever looks at like, okay, well, how much money's been printed? Could it be the case that there are 20% more dollars in circulation than there were 2 years ago? And then it's like, okay, let's factor in, I'll give you kind of slightly elongated example. All right, someone pays $1 million for a property. 5 years later, they sell it for $2 million. Woohoo, I made $1 million. I'm a real estate investor. Well, did you actually make $1 million? First of all, over those 5 years, if they lived in it themselves, they didn't create any revenue on the property. They had just expenses. So you've got property taxes, you've got maintenance, upkeep, all the different fees, you know, with living in a house. Maybe they did rent it out, but then they would have had to pay for agents to manage it. And maybe they had fallow periods where they were making no income. And actually, the occupancy was as low as 60% 1 year. And it's like, okay, well, how much revenue did you make in that five-year period? What were the costs of that five-year period? Okay, so now actually it didn't make $1 million. It's cost you money to get to that point. So it's cost you money to hold it over those 5 years. And then, oh, look, the government's actually printed 40% more dollars. So in my view, the real estate investors out there, they're not increasing purchasing power. And you can go and read books like what's it called? There's a book about the Weimar Republic, 1920s hyperinflation. I forget. I have to look it up. It'll be on my reading list somewhere. If anyone wants to know, then message me. I've completely forgotten. Oh, When Money Dies. That's what it's called. And basically, the market participants value things in a metric that they haven't understood in that, okay, I got more dollars today. Woohoo, I'm rich. They literally think they're getting rich. But actually what's happening is the denominator, i.e. the metric that they're measuring in, is disintegrating in value. And so when you go and map, you know, the average real estate price of a local neighborhood in gold, or you look at a stock market over the last 10 years in gold, you suddenly start to see there's very little change. Or you start to map the government's base money supply shifts against the growth of the stock market or against the real estate market, and you see they're almost completely the same. And this is wild. If you haven't stopped and asked yourself, is the value of the money I'm pricing assets in changing, then obviously you don't realize. And so when I get like these real estate deals, they come across my desk and I'm like, oh, I get kind of emotional about it. I imagine living in the place. But then when I physically go there, the price that's being asked versus the value that's delivered is just a monster gap. And I personally just cannot get there. I'm like, I'm not buying someone else's house that is essentially, you're inheriting all their problems, like all the shortcuts that were taken during the design process, all the shortcuts that were taken during the build process, all the money that wasn't spent since someone's owned it in order to like try and capture a bit of yield become your problem. And I think the conclusion we're coming to is like, what we actually want to do, buy a piece of land and build from scratch. And there's an architect we've come across that we really like, because the aim for us is to build a healthy home, right? Low tox, low EMF, no mold, nice and warm, lots of sunshine, plenty of grass. And it's not that I'm necessarily driven by the idea of like, oh, I want to like have a sustainable house, i.e. Paris Agreement 2050 must save the world, Greta, at all, but more like, we want to have a very safe and healthy place for us to raise a family in. And some of the modern building techniques just don't supply that. And actually this architect, again, if anyone's interested, reach out to me. Really sad story. His father-in-law died from chemical exposure as a builder. And as an architect, that's like what basically has formed his life's work. And he uses something called hempcrete to create walls. And it sounds awesome. And I'm going to learn a whole load more about it. But as an investor, I'm suddenly starting to see a better picture where it's like, I refuse to get involved in the game where buying the title of a property that you didn't build yourself, you're basically inheriting someone else's problem. And the only reason the price is shifting well, not the only reason, because immigration definitely counts and taste is part of it. There's actually just so many different factors that go into valuing a piece of real estate. But my strong feeling is that like 75, 80% of the price appreciation is happening because of the inflationary monetary supply. And people just aren't realizing that. So one way to create value is obviously take a piece of grass and build shelter. And that's what we're going to hopefully do. And we're going to try and build a family home. But it just, yeah, the real estate market's been winding me up recently because, oh yeah, the boom period of 2020 to 2022. And where I am was basically a bit of a haven from all of the crazy lockdown rules that happened in Australian cities at the time. So people rushed to come up here and spend their money. And equally, the Royal Bank of Australia printed a ton of dollars. So again, people think they're getting rich, but actually, what if it's the denominator falling in value? Anyway, I think that's a story I can repeat a million times and still people aren't paying attention. But I'm sitting in a great position where it's like, okay, I was able to reallocate into Bitcoin in a not even 5-year period. I feel like, you know, I control my own time. My balance sheet is healthier and my relationships around me are healthier with my wife and my kids. And that is unbelievably exciting position to be in. But then it's like, what's next? And then use this capital to deploy it in an effective way to help us for the future. And of course, somewhere to actually live, to have shelter is an important part of that. And it's something I'm really just figuring out. To add in a final piece on this, which is quite like, for want of another expression, woo-woo. I've been having some amazing sessions recently with an osteopath. He's talking about you have to get in alignment with the frequency of the land. And you can do that through meditation and through writing as well. And just today, we were doing this exercise where I was walking around his treatment room and I was being asked different questions and answering them and basically visualizing the future and moving forward into it and talking about how it felt. And there's a particular plot of land that I've seen that just seems completely out of my reach. But like, what if it isn't? And what if it's because the frequency you've been operating at just wasn't there yet? And yes, it looks like it might be something that's unattainable, but is it? And maybe you can engineer a situation where it's not. And that all requires you to be in alignment with it. And so yes, work in progress, we'll see how it goes. The final topic to discuss in this solo episode is the power of podcasting. So I'll just share a story with you. Shout out to Jason Parks, who came on the show and is my mentor at the moment, helping me learn all about energetics. Do wind back and listen to his episode. It's absolutely awesome. Anyway, it transpires that his wife, who I have yet to meet, I won't mention her name. I look forward to a meeting when the time comes. She has been really enjoying the podcast and the content I've been putting out. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your support and attention. And Jason told me a story where she had listened to an episode with Daz, who was on very recently. Shout out to Daz for joining. And Daz is currently travel schooling his two boys. Him and his wife and two sons are traveling in their caravan around Australia. A very popular thing to do for Aussies, I've since learned on moving here, and a brilliant way to access parts of Australia that just aren't possible otherwise, right? Really getting, you know, out in the sticks. And amusingly, Daz was saying he's actually been using ChatGPT to recommend the next location, i.e. we're looking for a small surf break that's only 2 hours from where we currently are and getting directions there, which is a thing of futuristic power. If I go back to when I was 19 years old and trying to cross Europe with a physical map and getting stuck in the outskirts of Brussels, it was an absolute disaster. Anyway, Daz mentioned an online learning platform that his boys have been consuming as part of their travel schooling. I'm not going to speak to the specifics of it, but dig it up. I think it's called Yuka, and it's mentioned in Daz's podcast as well. Anyway, it transpires that Jason and his wife are homeschooling one of their daughters, and during parts of the day, both of them are tied up with whatever commitments they have, and their daughter is slightly lacking direction. She's running out of things to do. And lo and behold, they listened to Daz's episode, checked out the educational platform, signed up to it in a matter of moments, and with any luck, I think have now already started. And Jason told me this story, and it just made me so, so bloody happy, because as a podcast, it's almost kind of a lonely journey in a sense. You set out, I can see an awesome journey, and the experience is going to be one of the highlights of my life as I build this over the next, you know, 5-10 years. But right now we're like month two and we've pumped out a bunch of episodes, but the amount of people listening is very, very small. You know, some videos on YouTube, 3 views, 4 views, some of the RSS feeds, you know, there's really not a lot of activity. And that's not to be unexpected. Like, this is about building a long-term sustainable content creation flow that basically is about people's stories and sharing wisdom and trying to grow together. But what you don't necessarily know unless someone tells you as the content creator is the impact that it actually has in people's lives. And so hearing this story was just, it made my day. Because like someone who's enjoying listening to the podcast has heard a piece of information, researched it themselves, and it's now bringing value to their family life. Like, how incredible is that? And so, you know, shout out to Jason and his wife for the journey they're on with their kids, and shout out to Daz and his wife for the journey they're on with their kids. And I really hope that this kind of thing can inspire more, basically. Like, so, you know, right now, those of you who are listening, thank you very much for your support. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, reach out. That's kind of what this is all about, is slowly but surely, you know, I'm pushing a snowball off the top of a mountain. At the moment, the snowball is absolutely tiny, but it will gain speed. It will get bigger. And with that, it will create more value for more people. And I'm just incredibly grateful to be able to go on this journey, to have built the infrastructure around me, the time, the space, the finances to actually pursue this. And I just couldn't be more excited when I hear stories like that, because it really hammers home like how powerful podcasting is, not just for me, the host, but for the audience. It feels like you're able to almost facilitate a kind of win-win-win scenario where the host, the guest, and the audience member are benefiting from these conversations. And so for that, like, I couldn't be more grateful and couldn't be more pumped about the future. At which point, I think that's probably enough for me today. I'll wrap it up there. So thank you so much for tuning in. Reach out if you've got any questions, and appreciate you guys so much. Thank you.